From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's bracing for what may come from the vantage of a high summer plateau of coronavirus cases.
And now you're going to be adding in this whole slew of those seasonal viruses that can look a lot like COVID.
Today we'll hear what indicators health professionals are watching. Also, a church in Macomb County hoists a Black Lives Matter banner only to find it vandalized repeatedly.
The third banner was stolen. The fourth was cut with a knife. The fifth was vandalized with spray paint. In our most recent incident, we had someone hang dog feces from our banner.
This pastor says her congregation will not give up. And one of Detroit's working designers talks about the revolutionary act of making.
It's easy to buy something, but when you buy something, it doesn't have a story with it. If you make it, then you have more of a memory embedded.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a church in Romeo grapples with systemic, politically motivated vandalism.
We took the banner down temporarily, had it resized to fit the new ordinance, and then we put it directly back up in the same position. And in that case, it lasted less than 24 hours, and it was vandalized.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, over the past 6 months, the COVID pandemic has gone through so many different phases, from the surge in the spring to summer outbreaks, and now here we are with so much uncertainty heading into the fall. Yes, we've learned a lot, but health professionals are also focusing on a few key questions right now in hopes of keeping as many people as safe as possible for the rest of the year. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been analyzing cases and talking to healthcare workers about what they're seeing. And she's here now. Kate, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, April. Someday we're going to talk about things that are not COVID-related together.
And
I cannot wait.
Me either. There's a lot of catch-up and a lot of coffee that we're going to need between now and then. Kate, when we look at where things are for Michigan right now, and again, I can't quite believe it's been 6 months, where are we in terms of the case numbers and the trends?
So we are, I'm finding it helpful, and I think we kind of all feel like we're thinking about this last 6 months in three phases, right? You've got the spring when we had the surge, you have this sort of like summer of COVID, and then you have where we are right now heading into the fall, which is sort of at this plateau. And I think it's helpful. I don't want to overwhelm you with numbers, but I think it's helpful to just sort of remember what these numbers have looked like. You know, back in mid-April, that was during the surge, and our sort of our peak was at something like, you know, an average of 1,600 new cases every single day. Really serious cases, you'd have several days where you'd see 150, 160 deaths. And that is sort of what we think of as kind of like the time period where those cases were so serious. Hospitals were at max capacity, and we had no idea how to treat this. You know, I was talking with, you mentioned healthcare workers. I was talking with a nurse tech at DMC earlier this week. His name is Sean Bradley. And that time has really stayed with him and a lot of his coworkers. And you know, they worry about this happening again. He says some of them just don't know if they can do it again.
They think they short staff. Not, they're not going to have no staff this time. And it dates back to the supplies, the demand of work, the level of work, and a hazardous pay situation. I heard a lot of people say they're not coming back.
I mean, that's something to worry about for sure. But I'm also wondering just about the areas that we're focusing on. Kate, what can we say about where infections were happening, say, over the course of the summer?
Yeah, so we went from having, in the spring, cases very much centralized around the Southeast Michigan, Detroit area, Oakland County, the city of Detroit, Wayne County. And then over the summer, as the lockdown phased out in June and you started seeing case numbers rise back up again after they had, you know, been brought down by the lockdown, these are happening all across the state.
So as we triangulate all these factors, sort of where, you know, which places in Michigan got overwhelmed and how many cases we had, maybe we should talk for a minute about what didn't happen. As the lockdown ended at the end of the springtime, we didn't see a huge surge of cases this summer. I mean, do we know why that is? What was different?
Yeah, so I think one reason you say that we didn't hit a surge is that instead we just kind of hit a high plateau, right? We've been for most of the summer in this space where we have an average of between 500, 700, 800 cases per day. Now, it's not as high as it was in the spring, and that's good, but it's almost like we have normalized and adapted to a really high level of case numbers that are just, you know, we just see them every day. We don't know what it's going to look like going into the fall. But like you said, it is not sort of this like giant peak followed by a lockdown and a shutdown with, you know, a big drop. The other thing that has been different and better this time is who's getting sick. You know, as the lockdown ended and people started going back to work and you'd see people socializing, it became more and more younger people who were getting sick, people in their teens, 20s, 30s especially. And, you know, we know that those people are often not as seriously ill when they get sick. So you have not seen hospitals and death rates, thankfully, go up. They've stayed very, very low compared to where we were in the spring. I was talking about this with Emily Martin. She is this great epidemiologist at the University of Michigan. And she says, you know, yeah, we had these various outbreaks kind of spotting up throughout the state during the summer, but you have to think of it as really this rise in cases kind of across the board.
So we didn't so much see a surge. We didn't see any impact on hospitals or the medical community per se, but we saw the waterline for infections go up. And we still see that. We still see this maintenance of this high plateau.
Okay, right. But Kate, at the same time, like you said, we are seeing individual outbreaks, college campuses, schools, or even in some cases, large social gatherings. It can feel like this fall is one big experiment. What's going to happen when the weather gets colder? What's going to happen when flu season kicks up? And you have these places where people are coming together in a big way.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the reason that we feel so uncertain, the reason that it feels like we're just all doing individual experiments at different colleges and different schools is because we are. You know, even the experts that I talk to are like, oh, we are as interested in anyone to see how these turn out. And I don't say that to be flippant. I say that as they are genuinely trying so many different things. You know, you hear about colleges testing sewage water. You hear about college campuses where they're trying to just do surveillance testing. You hear about colleges like MSU, you know, which went entirely remote at the last minute this year, but is still seeing 120 of their students test positive in the East Lansing area last week. So everybody is watching each of these individual experiments. And the good news from that is they hope that something will work. Somebody will come up with some best practices because we've got to figure out how to live with this virus going forward.
Now, you mentioned the flu. We should probably come back to that. It's a worry that you're hearing about a lot already, and I feel like we're going to hear more of it. The concern is, what happens if you get the flu and a COVID surge at the same time? Do we end up back in a place of having deeply stressed hospitals at capacity level?
Right. Like you said, that is the big concern heading into the fall. Not only that there will be outbreaks, but that these outbreaks will coincide with a lot of people, like they always do, having these seasonal viruses. And yes, a big concern is, what will that do to hospitals? You know, every year people do die from the flu, but not just what will that do to the hospitals and their capacity, but also the strategies that we have been using thus far is that when somebody has symptoms of COVID, you try to isolate them, right? You get them tested. And even just focusing on testing COVID, you have complications and shortages of supplies and long turnaround times with testing, depending on where you are. And now you're going to be adding in this whole slew of those seasonal viruses that can look a lot like COVID. Emily Martin, that epidemiologist I was talking to, says, you know, this is the new phase that we're going into.
And so if you think about in a normal school in January, how many kids are walking around with like, you know, sniffles and a cough, and they're like rubbing their nose on their sleeve. Now, all of those are going to be cases where we're trying to figure out whether or not we suspect COVID. Instead of just saying, oh, kids are germ factories, we're going to let them wander around. And so we're going into a situation we don't have a paradigm for.
Boy, yeah, she's bringing the real there. I remember when all this began, we were just all slathering ourselves with hand sanitizer. And I'd hear people balking about masks, saying, well, geez, that would be draconian if we all had to wear masks. And now you see masks just about every place you go in Michigan.
Well, so I would push back on that, on saying that you see masks everywhere you go in Michigan. I think it depends greatly on where you are. I think this is, you know, it's not news that this has been a politicized health issue, that there are people who are really feeling like this is an infringement on their freedoms. And so it is more complicated because of that. I also think, you know, I've been talking with experts about sort of, you know, we were talking about the plateau and how we've sort of normalized this, especially heading into the school year and trying to figure this out. And Martin, that epidemiologist, you know, she studied polio and how we came together and treated polio. And she says that was really a time where the entire community was united around solving this health issue. And you don't see that to the same extent right now as you even saw in the spring when there was this feeling, I think, you know, remember like late March, April, where it was sort of like, okay, we are all in this together. Part of that is how long it has been. Part of that is the politics of this. And also part of that is that we talked about those individual experiments. Everybody right now is trying something slightly different. So we used to kind of all be in the same boat, stuck at home, and now we are all sort of in our individual experiments.
I take it from the comments of Emily Martin and other folks you talked to that with schools back in session, health professionals are really keeping a close eye on things, as parents and teachers are, as for where the next place might be for an outbreak.
Yeah, I mean, it's there, and not just here in Michigan. You know, they're watching which K-12 schools are doing well internationally, which K-12 schools are doing well in, you know, throughout the rest of the United States. The issue that we, the additional challenge that we are facing is that we are reopening these schools in some cases. It's different everywhere you go, but we are reopening these schools before we have really curbed these numbers. You know, we're still in this high plateau phase that we've been for at least half this summer, and we're sending kids back to school, and that makes it really difficult to do that successfully.
Whew. Okay, so basically get your flu shot, hope, and watch for some lessons from the K-12 schools and college campuses.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to sound dire, but it's hope that somebody figures this out and what lessons can we learn from people who are able to do this well.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been reporting on COVID for us. Kate, thanks very much.
Thanks, April.
In just a moment, we're going to meet one of the winners of Detroit's Design in the City competition. A maker who knows no fear. She will tackle woodworking, jewelry, metal fabrication, and more.
I like to be well-versed in many things and not just one specific medium. That way, it's just more dynamic.
We'll meet her in a minute after we come back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As you heard here yesterday, Detroit Month of Design is going forward in spite of, or perhaps because, of the crises overtaking the city right now. From the pandemic to the eruption of concerns over police use of force, this is a time when we can look to the city's makers for ideas and energy. The Design in the City competition is lifting up a class of professionals working in fashion and related designs, including Therese Clark. She's a true superwoman of skills, designing jewelry, accessories, home decor. She's done work in backgrounds for companies like Foot Locker and Bumble, and is skilled in woodworking and metal fabrication. Clark has an installation called Her Hue that's on view in Detroit through September 30th, and you'll be able to see some of her work at a pop-up and trunk show this weekend. Therese Clark, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is there a story about sort of what made you a maker and how you started working with your hands?
So I grew up the only child, so my mom would always buy me different craft kits and jewelry kits to keep me busy. So that's really how I got started with things. I always wanted a project. So we would go to the local craft stores. I'd pick up a kit, do that, be finished with it probably in that same day. And then I would take apart different things around the house and put them back together.
It sounds like you would have been the perfect kid to have at a time when everyone was stuck at home.
Definitely. We would have had robots that bring you drinks or something if that was the thing back then.
Can you talk a little bit about how the different mediums that you work in, whether it's the woodwork projects that you're exploring right now, or some of the other things we've seen you work in the past, and fibers or other kinds of construction, how they shape your work?
So I think that all of the different mediums shape my work because it brings different elements to projects. So I like to be well-versed in many things and not just one specific medium. That way, it's just more dynamic. So if a piece is woodworking, I might still incorporate some metalsmithing into it by making the hardware. I might incorporate fibers into it by making signage that may be made out of materials that aren't wood. I just think it makes things more complete and well-rounded.
Is there a process when you're working with something new where you're just sort of like getting to know it and getting to know sort of the physical limitations and what's possible?
Yes. So I recently just started working with more acrylic, and it is not as forgiving as wood is. So if I mess up in wood, I can sand it down. Acrylic, you know, the plastic is harder to sand and to reshape. So I've been trying to start with smaller scale things instead of just hopping into large displays like I normally would with wood. So there's been a little cap on that, but I've been having fun experimenting since nothing is like currently due at the moment. So that pressure isn't there.
You mentioned acrylic. I know that you've done some work with it for the exhibition Her Hue. It's celebrating Black women's hair and trying to do some erasure on the stereotyping and, you know, some of the disrespect that Black women have had to deal with about their hair over the years. Could you tell us a little bit about what you have planned for the installation?
Yes. So the acrylic that I'm using in the installation, I actually use those to create like an aura glow around different women's hair silhouettes. And that was inspired by, honestly, the space that the installation is in. It used to be a hair salon. And the previous tenants, they left these really cool LED circles in the wall where mirrors used to be. And I wanted to make sure that I incorporated every inch of the space in some way and activated it. So it worked out that way. And then on top of the lights, I cut circular acrylic and added some color to it so that it's just not glowing white, so that it glows in different hues from pinks to blues. And then I traced silhouettes of my friends with their hair in puffs or shortcuts, hair braided back, and put that on top of it too, so that image is illuminated.
What was on your mind when you were envisioning what this installation was going to look like?
I wanted to really just bring forth all the beauty that is Black hair. So I just wanted to find a way to incorporate us and put us on display as art.
I feel like this is a topic that a lot of fine artists have been exploring a little bit more in recent years, but I don't really know if it's worked its way into everyday consciousness in the exact way that you're doing. Were there, you know, tactile things or visual things that you definitely wanted to incorporate?
Yeah, so one of the tactile elements is that you're able to touch some of the pieces that are braided sculptures. And that has just been because it's always been an ever-running theme that people want to reach out and touch Black women's hair.
White people. you're being very polite, but I think we mean white people wanting to reach out and touch Black women's hair.
Well, yeah, white people want to reach out and touch Black women's hair because our hair is so versatile. We change it a lot. We might come to work with braids one day and afro the next, and then it's like, oh, how did you grow your hair so long? Like, it's extensions. But there's always a wanting to touch, always some curiosity around our hair. So this way, I'm hoping to satisfy some of those curiosities so that no one asks to actually touch someone's hair that's on their head.
That sounds like almost a risky choice, you know, and it's definitely acknowledging, you know, one of the tropes and one of the things that obviously drives Black women crazy, but also acknowledging that there may be a seed of curiosity in those exchanges.
A lot of it is just being curious. I don't think it's meant to be harmful in any way. Our hair types are different. So you would want to, you know what it feels like. But I just think it is inappropriate to ask a woman to touch her hair or just to reach your hand out without asking.
Obviously.
So I don't want it to like open up a can of worms where you're asking everyone to touch their different textures like it's a petting zoo. But yeah. I want this installation to take place of that.
One of the things that feels complicated about it to me is just that, you know, a white woman saying to a black woman, oh, can I touch your hair? It's different. Even that word different feels like that could be painful in some ways. Were there ways in which you just wanted people to see that variation is the normal?
Yes, I definitely want it to be more normalized, that our versatility is more normalized. Because no one wears their hair the exact same way every single day. You might wear it down, you might wear it in a ponytail. I think that we just put a little more self-expression into our hair. So it's more of our identity as well.
Treece Clark, I wanted to ask you a little bit wider picture about what's been going on with your year. There are a whole lot of makers who've had to keep up a furious pace to make ends meet at a time when maybe they're not able to sell their products in the same way that they used to. Maybe they're not able to conduct classes or take classes in the same way that they have before. How would you say your workflow and your livelihood have been affected by the pandemic?
It's definitely been affected, but I would say in a more positive way. I'm trying to be mindful of my words because I know that there's a lot going on and people are losing their lives. But I have been finding a lot of joy in this time just because this pause has forced me to do things that I've always talked about doing. So I always wanted to do more things online so that things are more accessible. And now we all like have to make that pivot to be very engaged online. So with my work, instead of being more in person, with how I did designer hack classes and the tutorials, I have been able to make more Instagram TV videos for people to watch and share. Even my son and I baking bagels and showing people how we did that. Honestly, in this time, I'm just doing all of the things that I wrote down in my journal years ago that I didn't have the time to do, just revisiting those ideas and picking them up.
If you're just joining us, my guest is artist and designer Treece Clark. She's one of the recipients of this year's Design in the City Competition Awards, part of Detroit Month of Design. I wonder, is there a contrast between what's going on right now and the way your work and your business has been going over the past couple of years? I mean, handmade goods have been a serious part of Detroit's economic revival. How have the past couple of years been treating you?
The past couple of years have treated me very well. I used to vend at probably all of the marketplaces, Eastern Market, different pop-ups through Build, because I am an alumni of Build as well. So I would say I've definitely seen more interest in things being handmade. Instead of people rushing to stores for certain products, they look for local small businesses to create those same things that they will go out and buy just because they want something more unique or custom for them. And I think everyone wants a little handmade in their home nowadays.
You've done many original designs, but I've also seen some videos that you put out of designer hack work, showing people how to make their own on-trend stuff. What do we get when we wear things that we get to make ourselves?
There's definitely a different sense of pride when you make something yourself. Because when you receive that compliment from a stranger, and then you get to say, oh, thanks, I made it. At the end, there's just a different light that comes with that.
What's more complicated, making your own designs or figuring out how somebody else made something and showing someone else how to do it?
Honestly, probably making your own designs, because inspiration is definitely all around us. So it's hard not to absorb or consume what's going on around you. So if I'm always head in fashion magazines, I feel like some of that may translate into my own personal work. So I feel like it's easier to recreate some things that I've seen.
Do you notice the difference between what kinds of products are a hit these days versus the kind of things that people were interested in maybe back in January or February?
Definitely. I feel like everyone is into more home decor nowadays since we're spending so much time. Because we're spending so much time in the house, and now we're like, okay, this room is missing a rug. Oh, we're missing a lamp. Okay, this needs something. So definitely home decor. I know that there's definitely been an uptick in those sales And just the videos too. Probably my home decor projects have the most views of anything else.
Can you give us an example?
I made some hand-stamped pillows in a video. So people really took to that because it was a really simple project, a no-sew project. All you needed was a little bit of fabric. We used muslin, cut out a little design to be your stamp. It could be an abstract image, like just a triangle that you are moving different ways to stamp. You paint it, stamp it on the fabric, stuff the pillows with some polyfill and hot glue the edges. Because not everyone has needle and thread, but we can definitely have a $2 hot glue gun lying around the house.
Is there a difference between how you connect with people, maybe when you meet them at a physical marketplace, and how you connect with them now when maybe you're not even physically seeing them? Maybe your interaction with them is what you show them online.
Yeah, so I feel like I'm initiating conversation, but talking to myself a lot of the time.
It's a different skill.
Yeah. Like I'm talking to myself initially because I'm maybe doing a voiceover on a video. But once people begin to comment back and forth, then we actually get some conversation going. In person, I feel like it's a little tougher, honestly, just because you may not know what their interests are. And how do you just walk up to someone and start talking about, you know, chairs and furniture? But online, they're already following you because they have that interest. So it's a little easier to spark up conversation that way, too.
You know, I'm a little hesitant to ask this question because you put a great deal of work and intention into all the things you make. Because of that, I don't know if your downtime or what revives you is spent making things. You know, I mean, like I've known people who are professional chefs who they don't really want to cook when they get home. But are there things that are reviving you right now? I wondered if those things have anything to do with making stuff.
They definitely have a lot to do with making things, but just in a different light. So more nurturing things. So just taking the time out to cook a meal from scratch is very reviving, because if I had a really busy week and I've been eating terribly, then I definitely want to put some love back into myself and make a really good meal. So that's one of the things that has been reviving me. Even making bath bombs with my son too, so that we're doing some self-care that way. I think the process of making is just very therapeutic for me, especially when it's making for yourself and not making with a deadline in mind. So I can just take my time truly in things and do it together, because the memory making process as well is really big with us, because it's easy to buy something, but when you buy something, it doesn't have a story with it. If you make it, then you have more of a memory embedded.
When you think about home goods and the kind of things that you want to surround yourself with right now, what comes up?
I definitely want to surround myself with things that make me happy. So I love tactile things, of course. So I like furs and silks. I want to surround myself with unique pieces from other makers. I want to see wall art always on my wall. I don't like plain walls at all. I'm somewhere bordering between being eclectic and being a hoarder, because I always find great things that I want to keep or just redo, remake, reupholster. I probably have a basement full of chairs that I found, like outside things. But I always want to surround myself with things that were handmade and unique for sure.
I can't say it's entirely shocking to hear that a seasoned maker like yourself has a lot of projects in progress. Like anyone who knows anybody who sews or does woodwork is just waiting to see that shed or that sewing room all filled up with stuff that just hasn't quite found its project yet.
I revisit things a lot too. So I might not have a plan for it when I first see it, but I know that it's cool enough to, you know, have a purpose later. So if I find like a couch on the side of the road that has a really cool shape, I say, okay, I might not have a plan for right now, but it's being tossed. So I have to get it now and put it away. And I'll come back to it once I have time or the idea of how I want to do things.
Well, Therese Clark, we want to thank you so much for everything that you've made for Detroit Month of Design. And thanks for talking to us a little bit about your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Arts and Culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Michigan's performance landscape was already plenty interesting, and it just became exponentially more so. Michigan Opera Theater has hired as its new artistic director, Yuval Sharon. The New York Times calls him perhaps the most innovative opera director working in America. He spoke at a physically distanced press conference today.
It is really an honor to be able to accept this role as artistic director, even if this is certainly a strange way to accept it.
Yuval Sharon has worked with ensembles like the Cleveland Orchestra and the L.A. Philharmonic. Most recently, he's been running a mid-sized operation in L.A. called The Industry. They do things like an operatic adaptation of War of the Worlds and convince the city to let them use the old air raid sirens to ratchet up the audience's visceral reaction. He's kind of a unicorn mix of musical chops and innovative thinking about what makes operatic stories hit home.
Opera in Detroit should look and feel and sound like no other opera company in the world. It should have Detroit's attitude. It should have Detroit's style. And what we see reflected on the stage should be Detroit's aspirations, its fears, and its dreams.
Sharon's first act, a new work that radically reinterprets a Wagnerian classic from the Ring cycle, staged in a downtown garage with some help from your car radio. Cannot wait to talk to this guy. In other stories, it's a new curriculum for Mackinac Island. Stay tuned to hear about it in just a couple of minutes. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When Pastor Kim Newport took a job leading Romeo, Michigan's UCC Church, she didn't know she'd be leading congregants through one of the most tumultuous periods of modern history. And Kim Newport knows something about tumult. It also happens that she is the church's first openly gay pastor. And she has some history in leading uncomfortable conversations. But the past 3 months have been a challenge to everyone in so many ways, especially because of an incident that's come up with the church and its community in the past few months. Pastor Kim Newport joins us now. Kim, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your congregation.
Well, our church is located in Romeo, which is a pretty small village in northern Macomb County. And the congregation is fairly small, but has a real heart for social justice in the community and in the greater world. That's really what drew me to it. We averaged before the pandemic with around 40 people on a Sunday morning. Since we've been doing everything virtually, we've been averaging around 200 or more people for each Sunday morning.
Back in March, the country came to this moment when George Floyd was killed, and the congregation made a decision to hang out a Black Lives Matter banner. Can you tell us a little bit about how that decision was reached?
All of us in the church were very distressed about the death of George Floyd, and a Black Lives Matter march was orchestrated through the village of Romeo, which was very tumultuous because Romeo is a more conservative community. And at the end of that march, the church was asked if we would ring our church bells from our bell tower for the length of time that George Floyd had suffered in his death. And the day after that march, we hung up a Black Lives Matter banner in our front lawn. Actually, it was right next to our LGBTQ plus pride banner that we also put up every year in support of the gay community.
How long did the Black Lives Matter banner last?
The first banner lasted less than a week, and then we ended up taking that one down because the sign ordinance in the village of Romeo changed, and we were informed by the police that we had to get a new banner that met the new criteria that they had made. And so we took the banner down temporarily, had it resized to fit the new ordinance, and then we put it directly back up in the same position.
If this doesn't get into the weeds too much, I was wondering what the issue was with signage with the first banner.
The Village of Romeo had met prior to us putting up that banner, and their concern was with the political environment growing and people beginning to put a lot of political signs out in their yards. They wanted to limit the size and the amount that people could put up inside of the village limits. And our banner was significantly larger than what we were now allowed to have. So we just took it down and replaced it with the correct size.
How long did that second banner last?
The second banner lasted less than 24 hours, and it was spray painted with graffiti.
And what was the fate of the third banner that you hung up?
The third banner was stolen. The fourth banner was cut with a knife. The fifth banner was vandalized with spray paint. And then in our most recent incident, which was just on Sunday, we had someone hang dog feces from our banner.
Pastor, do you feel like the police are taking this seriously?
I believe strongly that the Romeo Police Department does not want crime in the village. I believe that they have looked into each incident. I just don't think there's been enough evidence in any of the cases to be able to press charges against anyone.
You know, I feel like you're not a stranger to small town life yourself, and your congregants are certainly aware of the town in which they live and how people might feel about what's happening politically, both in Romeo and all around the country. What would you say the effect of the vandalism has been on the congregation?
I believe it's made the congregation more aware of how vital our mission is for the community. We believe very strongly in equality for all people. And I think it has brought attention to the congregation that that is not the case, and that there are people who feel very strongly against the Black Lives Matter movement, against our position on equal rights in terms of sexuality, even in terms of equal rights as me as a female in leadership. I think all of those things have really become evident to people that there are a lot of people who oppose what we're trying to do in our community.
Are you more inclined to believe that the people responsible for the vandalism are people who are explicitly concerned about Black Lives Matter, or are you more inclined to think that these are people who see themselves as bomb throwers or pranksters?
I believe that the majority of people do have a problem with Black Lives Matter. We have also faced some of the same kind of discrimination in terms of our stance with the LGBT movement as well, with our Pride banner. Although it wasn't ever vandalized, we had people call the police and try to have us forced to take it down. So I believe that there's definitely a level of oppression in the community that we're seeing now more than ever.
May I ask, what's keeping you going?
I believe that there is a possibility in this world for equality. I believe that we do have an opportunity each and every day to have peace and to make a difference in this world, each of us. That's basically what I'm trying to do, is to just stay vigilant and to raise awareness for people of color and for people who feel that they don't have a voice. And I guess that passion is just what keeps me going.
Do you think that the church will continue to hang the Black Lives Matter banner out?
We're planning to keep the banner out right now indefinitely. I could see us probably changing it to something else, equality focused, maybe around the holiday season. But at this time, we have no intention of taking it down.
Has anyone suggested to you that you do so?
There are people in the community that have voiced their opinions that they would prefer if the banner is removed. But we have ultimately just explained that we're sorry that they feel that way, but it's not going to come down.
Are you getting any guidance from leadership within the United Church of Christ on the dispute and the vandalism? Or for that matter, are you getting any blowback?
The United Church of Christ in general, as a denomination, is standing behind this exact same movement that my individual church is. You know, we have the full support of our denomination in what we're doing. And the United Church of Christ on a national level is taking initiatives to really look at race and racial divide in our country and how we can go about being the peacemakers during such a difficult time in our history.
Pastor Kim Newport of the United Church of Christ Congregation in Romeo, Michigan. Pastor Newport, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We had assumed that vacation time was more or less over for most Michigan families, but businesses on Mackinac Island are asking folks to take a second look. Several of the island's resorts have come together to find reasons for people to come stay this fall as a way to help their kids learn. Liz Ware is with the marketing department with Mission Point Resort on Mackinac Island. Liz, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's good to talk to you. We last checked in with you in springtime, and I just wanted to start out by asking how the summer went.
It went remarkably well. Mackinac is perfectly positioned to have guests over the course of the summer. We remained very diligent with safety protocols, and we had a lot of people coming. It was really great.
Do you have any sense of how the number of overnight stays you did this summer might compare with years past?
Sure. So we ran at about a steady 85% occupancy. Typically in July and August, that would be closer to 100%. We would have been able to do that had we had more staff, but we just couldn't fully service the hotel with the amount of staff that we had. So the demand was absolutely there. And we're seeing that going into the fall as well.
That's interesting. It's sort of in line with what we've seen for some service industry businesses and retail on the mainland. You know, it's not so much the consumer demand, but just who you can get to help you out at a time when folks have health concerns.
Absolutely.
So how did the idea for education-oriented stays for families come up?
Well, a lot of our business in the fall is typically meetings and group business, and that obviously is not taking place this year. But with everyone being working from home and school being online, it's just the perfect opportunity to go up to the island and take your online classes, your work, but also then really get to know the island and everything it has to offer. There is so much history on the island. There's arts, culture. There's so many opportunities to immerse yourself and to learn while you're getting away and enjoying things.
The first thing that popped into my mind, Liz, was, can I do this? I mean, the reason I usually come to Mackinac Island is to get away from my screens, partly in because, if I may say so, the Wi-Fi infrastructure has not really been conducive to constantly checking Facebook every 5 minutes. I mean, that was something I valued, but is it possible for people to stay connected if they have classes or, you know, some work from home that they need to do?
Absolutely. So over the past year or so, we have really worked to upgrade the Wi-Fi and the connectivity on the island, and especially at Mission Point. So we have a conference center that was recently renovated, and we are fully capable of having everyone come in, get a workspace, and be able to connect.
So what were the interested parties here able to come up with to offer to maybe families who are homeschooling their kids this year?
So we have garden tours and history tours and a lot of books and things for people to look at. But the state park really stepped it up and put together a whole series of guided tours with online materials as well, so that you can go through and then you can go through the state park, you can go through the fort, and then you can go back online and do their worksheets. And that's really great, which is something that they haven't done in the past, and which we will continue to see that as a valuable resource.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else to the packages that are being offered right now that are a little beyond the realm of what you usually offer?
Sure. Just the fact that we have dedicated spaces for families to work and learn from. We haven't done that in the past. We can provide box lunches and really give people a dedicated space outside of their hotel room to work. And then obviously after that, go out and enjoy the island and learn through immersion.
Have you had any takers so far?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We actually, in fact, last Sunday, we had a couple that walked in the door at Mission Point and said, we were going to have a big wedding next year, but we'd like to get married right now. And they did. We got it all set up for them.
Wow. Have many families been booking to maybe bring their kids for the homeschooling opportunities?
Yes, they absolutely have. And a lot of people have said it's just a terrific opportunity to get away from the home and really start the school year off with an exciting adventure.
Do the packages take health and safety into consideration?
We take health and safety into consideration every day at Mission Point. We do ask that guests wear masks. They do need to wear their masks in the lobby. It is something that is extremely important. Not only is it an executive order from the governor, but if it isn't being taken seriously, people can get sick. And we absolutely don't want to do that. We don't want to close our doors. So it is something that's of extreme observation and caution at Mission Point and throughout the island.
Would you say that there were lessons learned over the summer, either at Mission Point or among all the businesses on the island, about how this can work or whether it can work at physical distance?
From the beginning of COVID-19, Mackinac Island took it very seriously. We have a unique environment there. And members of the city council, the mayor's office, business leaders, community leaders all came together and created a task force. We have met consistently at least once a week to discuss issues on the island and to make sure that there was enforcement of the executive orders and complete understanding of what needed to take place in order for us to open. Because at one point in time, we weren't sure if we were even going to be able to open. So not only were we able to open, but we maintained most of a season, which was really, really remarkable. But it's only being done because we're very cautious about it.
Liz, how far into the fall do you think these packages can extend Mackinac Island's tourist season?
So typically our season ends the third week of October with the race. And the race won't be happening this year, but we do see people coming. So I think there are going to be a couple of factors. It is going to be what's happening at the schools and the weather and people's ability to feel comfortable. So right now we are looking at having packages available until the 24th of October, which would be the last day that we would be open.
Yeah. And how far would you say that there's a number or a date? I mean, I don't know if like a 1-for-1 ratio for extending the season would even be useful right now, but what do businesses on the island have to recoup in order to stay viable?
I think it's different for each business. For us, a lot of our business in the fall was the group business that is no longer there. So we are looking at, not only did we open 2 months late when we were only open for 6 months to begin with, we lost a lot of that group business. So it has been a challenging year. However, as I said, we've done better than we had expected to do. And I think that a lot of the island businesses are in the same position. It wasn't the best year by any means, but we came out of it better than we thought we would.
Right. I know that last time we talked, you were not actually on the island, but I'm guessing you did get up there this summer.
I absolutely did get up there this summer. The island is one of my favorite places in the entire world.
Right. So what was the vibe like on the island in June, July, and August?
The vibe on the island was happy. I can't remember seeing so many smiling faces. People were happy to be out and to be enjoying the Great Lawn and to be seeing other people. There was absolutely social distancing, but it was a happy, happy vibe.
Liz Ware is Marketing Director for Mission Point Resort on Mackinac Island. Liz, it's very good to talk to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that's our show for today. Producers on Stateside include Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Interns are Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. I'm April Baer. Thank you for showing up with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.